first, I'd like to welcome Stephanie Senator, our city council liaison. Welcome, Councilor. And we're delighted that you're able to join us. Any questions, ask Melanie. Or Michael, who's been here for some time, he's our local historian. Any announcements?
Yeah, a couple announcements. Yesterday, I believe it was yesterday, that appeal was filed for the cottage housing development at Laurels on Laurel Street 476. So that will be noticed for the council April 16th meeting. If you recall, that's a 12 cottage unit project. And then we also passed out next week, April 2nd and 3rd, it's the Southern Oregon Planners Network meeting. Generally one's held in the region annually. I think Ashland was a couple of years ago when we hosted it. I think some of you have attended over time. I mean, actually this year, a couple of Ashland projects or innovations will be highlighted. There's a middle housing strategy session that I know, I believe, Derek is on a panel to highlight our cottage housing ordinance. I think Mark Knox and maybe a design professional from his group will also be on that panel, as well as some others. And then there's a session on natural hazards, which I believe Brandon's going to speak to Ashland's wildfire ordinance. And then our own Maria Harris is on the board of Oregon American Planning Association, cool. So she'll be there as well. The only thing before, I just want to at least get this in before we jump to public forum, because I'm not sure who signed up or not, but we did receive, there was a site plan handed out to you today, and I just need to, I guess, warn you that there's still, we have an application at the department that involves this piece of property, so I would suggest you probably not look at the site plan, and if the property owner is here to speak to open space, keep it general. I mean, I think it can be general rather than site specific. Otherwise, I mean, we're running the problem with ex parte contact.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for a heads up on that. I already looked at it, but I didn't know. But by the time it comes before us, I will have forgotten all of it. We have three people to speak for public forum. Dr. Leander Ziegler, can you come forward, please? You have 3 minutes.
Yeah, very good. Good evening, commissioners. My name is Dr. Leanne Zipper. I'm the owner of a small Ashland property situated at 260 Avery Street in the R2 zone. And tonight I'd like to address the fact that density bonuses for major rec facilities have largely not been sought or implemented. Why is that? Because the execution risk and a development place from a vaguely formulated purpose and an undefined assessment process really outweigh the potential benefits. We have an opportunity to improve that. So I hope we can agree that if a recreational facility is one that is offered by Ashland's own park and rec department, it should immediately satisfy those intent and purpose for the density bonus. In doing so, we enable Ashland to realize higher density multifamily developments, more rentable units from the buildable land or infill inventory, but also higher quality developments that succeed in blending housing with recreation. So in review of the code, chapter 18 states the point, or states that points may be awarded for the provision of major recreational facilities such as, and it lists tennis courts, swimming pools, playgrounds, or similar facilities. Maria Harrison, in her comments, suggested that that should be looked at. I agree. Because is it in the spirit of the code to always and only build tennis courts, swimming pools, and playgrounds? Is it in the spirit of the code to only accept tennis courts and swimming pools, which impose dimensions that make them unsuitable for the majority of Ashland's R2 and R3 lots, especially the smaller lots, up to 24 acres? I think you will agree that that's not the case, but the word similar is not very well defined, it's not objective. So I'm proposing that we go with the definition of major recreational and facility in determining whether or not to grant the bonus. Major is a prominent, significant in size, great importance or interest. Now that's automatically guaranteed because the density bonus is always directly proportional to the facility's development cost in relationship to the project value. Is it recreational? Here I propose that indeed if it's offered by the City of Ashland Park and Rec Department, it should automatically satisfy that. Everybody living here knows that how well of a job the department is doing in providing recreation. Finally, facility, if it's met by providing a place or a piece of equipment specifically provided for that particular purpose or recreation. So if such a test is adopted, we will see more developers integrating facilities into their planning and designing process. Great example would be the inclusion of community gardens. So thank you for the opportunity to speak tonight and to speak here and contribute tonight.
Okay, thanks for your comments. Monica Neary?
Good evening, commissioners and staff. Thank you for all of your time in looking at amending this ordinance. For more than 2 years, my partner and I have been working on a 9-unit subdivision in the R2 multifamily zone with PSO overlay. The intention of our project is to be an attractive approach to multifamily rental development, an approach that achieves a lighter footprint by implementing sustainable building practices, increased open space, recreational space, and garden areas to produce food, and a harmonious balance of privacy and community-style living. We consider our concept an attractive alternative to an apartment complex. We conducted market research, took surveys, and learned tenants highly prefer private, open, and recreational space. They want room to grow their own food, and that very few people actually want to live in an apartment building. The code changes and clarification proposed by Maria support this style of development and removes a good deal of risk from our project, giving us a path to move forward, knowing we adhere to the code. Some concerns on suggested changes remain. First, MH6, which requires the dimensions of private recreational areas to be 6 feet. I do not believe the minimum dimension of recreational areas should be the same for single-family home, multi-family zones, PSO overlays, etc., or for a 700-square-foot home versus a 2,500-square-foot home. In my letter provided earlier today, I highlight other Oregon cities that provide a more flexible application of recreational space. For example, Bend requires lower and upper-level recreation spaces to be a minimum of 4 feet deep, and Lake Oswego requires lower recreation space to be 5 feet deep and upper space to be a minimum of 3 feet deep. I feel strong that consideration should be given to change the Ashland Code to allow for appropriate zoned recreational space to be narrower, more like 5 feet with lower levels and 4 feet with upper levels, and that additionally smaller areas should be allowed to provide for edible medicinal type of gardening, 2 to 3 foot wide strips. Under 18.3.9.0.2.A, common open space, which is the density bonus, is only held under common ownership. I would like to suggest that consideration be given to allow for private ownership of common open space. This option could allow a project to more easily meet setbacks and a density bonus. The private area used on a common open space could have deed of use and access as common open space and be owned in private. The first page I handed out is an example on how lots 3, 4, and 5 show that the recreational space surrounding the common open space could be used as common open space, but it is held in private ownership. Finally, MH4 talks about counting some walkways as recreation. I agree that thoroughfares should be counted as recreation space if they provide for recreational use or make for recreational use possible. For example,
you can just finish up.
Yeah, I provided you another.
Yeah, and we have your letter. Thank you.
Okay, yes, I provided you a picture there, and it shows a design that was designed to flow inside to the outside.
That's pretty. Thank you for your comments. Hill's Kitchen.
Thank you. What are we going to do about climate change? We're just going to run. I'm going to retire. Okay. This is retirement. Renewable energy is and has been decided to be the solution to climate change. That's all electricity is a techie thing. We all have to learn electricity. Yeah. The kids do. We have to learn electricity. Electrical engineering is a simple part of it. And all what you're talking about everywhere here is you're forgetting about the cars and the houses that soak up all the energy that should be used for letting the cars go. How many of you have ever even heard of an energy upgrade? There was a time back in 09, 07, 08, 09, the code people along with a bunch of other people, and I watched it really carefully, were considering, or they really tried to do energy audits, which was a preliminary to the energy upgrade. If you're going for the energy upgrade, that's when you go into a house and when it's sold and sent the carpenter, the number he's doing, okay, goes in and seals up all the cracks. And if they can, with really a good carpenter, you can save, you can reduce 30% of the electricity and the total energy gas too. Of the home. Then there's a whole bunch of other things that can follow that would make sense for this carbon reduction, carbon elimination, not adding any more carbon, zero net energy when sold. Well, that would be, there's talk about that. In other words, when a house is empty, you just go in and you make it zero net. Well, that's really hard to do. Or zero net energy for new. Everything new, not just be, you know, a little bit or sustainable, but absolutely have, added energy. And then there's autonomous for new, which is no wires in, no wires out, no gas pipes in. That means for sure they have to perform, the builders can learn it in time. And then there's EV-ready wiring for new. Well, we don't have any of that. I mean, that's just crazy. EV wiring ready for everything on the really key list before sold. We have none of this. This is still our future. And it's a long for the kids. And we have to do, we don't know the future. But it looks like the science is clear. It's a lot of work. We should all quit our jobs and just study the science. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gutchen. We have one discussion item tonight, which Marina is going to be discussing. And then we have an update later. So this is something we started discussing in very broad brush about 2 weeks ago, a month ago.
January was the last study session. It was this year. So,
check out the year part. Thank you.
Yeah. So, this is, Chair Pierce said, this has been discussed at the Planning Commission several times, most recently in January. This is also something that staff continues to get questions from applicants regarding the open space and recreation area requirements. So, what we did at the January meeting, it seemed like the commission was most concerned with fixing the inconsistencies in the code to improve the planning application and review process. So as a starting point for our discussion, staff drafted an ordinance with some of the key issues that were discussed and focused on clarification and cleanup. We used kind of as our baseline the way the code had been applied in past applications. So we really haven't made any significant changes to the policy core of the open space and recreation area requirements. So what I'm going to do is go through several examples of past approved developments to sort of highlight how it's been used in the past. So the first is the open space requirement for subdivisions and single family zones. And the example I'm using is the Hellman Springs subdivision, which was approved in 2007 and then built. It was a little pause because the recession hit, but then it was built several years later. And so this is it's in a single family zone, what we call R15. And there were 17 new homes, 17 new lots plotted. It was a little under 4 acres. And I think the thing to keep in mind in the outline plan performance standards options chapter requires that natural areas are included in open space, common areas, and unbuildable areas. So this commission, I think Commissioners Midland and Dawkins were probably on the commission when the subdivision came through, but probably everybody else on the commission wasn't. So, and we haven't had that many single family subdivisions, you know, since the recession. So it's not as common of a type of application. But normally in the single family subdivisions in the past, that open space requirement is used for natural features. So in this case, this was a large wetland that was preserved in open space. These were also wetland areas. This is the home of the original Hellman Baths from Abel Hellman, one of the founders of Ashland. So the wetlands were kind of seepage from the pool that's to the north. This is the actual wellhead for the spring that was preserved in open space. And then there were a large set of trees, or not a large set, but there were some large trees over in the corner that were incorporated into open space. So really, again, that open space requirement was centered around preserving natural features. And in this case, they provided one of just under 4 acres in open space. So it was far exceeded the 5% requirement that is required for a subdivision over 10 units. So the next example, this is just to show you how it's platted. This was a survey, and again, those green areas were actual common areas in the subdivision. So the next example is recreation areas in a multifamily development. So these are multifamily units, and I think many of you toured this location. Sorry. At Percy Street, it's a 11-unit apartment project. One of the units is a home up in the front, and the rest are small units. But the main area, so the open space in this case was divided between a private deck in the middle that we're kind of looking at with that, I think, umbrella there. That was to satisfy the 8% recreation area requirement. And then there were private decks for each of the units that were counted. And then the main house has a porch and a backyard area. So all that was counted to satisfy the open space requirement.
Where is that open space requirement from?
Recreation area requirement. So these were apartments.
That's from the site plan, not the PSO?
Yeah. Okay. It's a multifamily development.
I think it's helpful for the, you know, to talk about the three different areas we're talking about.
So this is not a subdivision. This is a multifamily development. So you can't see it very well, but that deck area that we were looking at is just in the middle of the plan. It was just under 500 square feet. And then the third area is where the two get combined, where you have a subdivision in a multifamily zone. So you have the open space requirement from the subdivision process and the recreation area requirement from multifamily development standards. And a couple of examples there. I think you're all familiar with 1068 East Main, which is just right down the street here and under construction right now. And so that's in the multifamily zone, R3. And there again, I don't know if you remember this from the hearing, but the bright green areas are the common open space, and then the orangish areas on the porches and patios were the private areas that were counted as open space. So there again, that ended up getting split. The requirement for the 8% recreation area was divided between those two, between the common spaces and the porches. And then this is from in the early 2000s. Wanted to show you another townhome development on is between Scenic and Rock, and I think there were 7 units. And here, this is an example. It's a little hard to see. Maybe I'll get up and point at it. But the actual where they counted both, they didn't have.
This was a subdivision, so it was in a multifamily zone, but it's private, individually owned lots. But it's less than 10 units, so they don't have to satisfy that open space requirement. So they're just subject to the recreation area, which they provided all in these backyard areas. So each one had a backyard that was at least 15 feet deep with a patio. Because it was a subdivision, they were required to preserve natural features. There were some large trees here and here. So it ended up, when it was platted, this area here and this area here were actually common areas. So it's again a combo.
Common area in the sense that it's commonly owned?
Yeah.
Not privately owned.
Yes. So I just wanted to frame that we were, you know, it's not always, we were just kind of trying to sense where the commission was in January. It seemed like it was focusing on cleanup and clarification, so we came up with a draft ordinance. We really based it on the way it's been applied in the past as a starting point. And what we heard at that meeting, we thought, was we need to distinguish between open space and recreation area, specify the types of recreation areas in multifamily that are allowed, that you can count, and then clarify the applicability of density bonuses for open space and recreation area. So at what point you need to count density bonuses? So we've tried to take a first stab at it here. For you to, mm-hmm. It seemed like to have something to look at and discuss would be a good way to start.
Okay.
That's really it. Yeah.
Okay. Any questions for Maria?
I just have a clarification question. So in all of these areas for meeting the 5%, the 8%, the 2%, these different requirements, is it always appropriate to combine both commonly owned and privately owned areas, or are there some categories in the code that must be held as commonly owned?
The way the code reads now, when it's a subdivision, you're supposed to have common area for the to preserve the natural features.
If common area is defined as owned by a homeowners association or the public or something.
And so are we talking about just the design standards for residential development, not the overlay? Is that
the
section of the code?
No, it's the performance standards overlay is a way of developing subdivisions.
Okay.
I should have clarified that. When I say subdivision,
you're always talking about that. Okay. So I'm just trying to find where that is. I'm seeing Section 3, Open Space Required. And I'm seeing B2, Provision of Common Open Space.
Yeah, so it's on page 3, that 3, Open Space Required. That's from the performance standard.
Right. So 10 units or greater, a minimum of 5%. In open space, and that is defined as being commonly owned right now.
Yeah, the language, I should have put a note there, the language that I added to the end there is actually in the definition of open space now, which in 2015 was pulled from the performance standards options chapter. So I think it was the case where a standard was embedded in a definition, and it seemed more appropriate to put it in the actual standard. So if you go to the definition on page 5 for open space, that cross out area,
are you talking about page 3 of your markup, open space required?
Yes. That's from the performance standards options chapter.
Okay. Okay, well, I don't see the definitional section that you're referring to.
That's
on
page 5.
That's page 5.
But I thought you were saying that you had modified it to include the definition somewhere.
Yeah, so it says a common area, that the crossed-out part of common area designated on the final plans of the development permanently set aside for common use of residents of the development. So it is changed a little, but that was the intention of that sentence that says on page 3. The common.
Okay, so that was my question, is so that means it can't be private. I don't think that is abundantly clear.
Okay.
From that, to say that it's permanently set aside for use of the residents of the development, that could mean private use of some of the residents. I don't think it's clear that it means commonly owned for the use of all the residents.
Okay.
So that.
And the question is what we want it to mean.
Yeah, what do we want it to mean?
What do we want it to mean?
Right.
That's
but
a big question.
That, the intention and the status quo right now, as you understand it, is that for developments of 10 or more, they would have to provide this 5% as commonly owned open space.
Correct. Yeah, and I mean, I think I explained in the memo to understand the legislative history and that the performance standards option subdivision, when it was originally crafted, was single for single family subdivisions. So when you create single family subdivisions, they typically have their own, because the lots are larger, they have their own private yard area. So the open space was more geared towards being a common area for use.
And a lot of that was geared towards, you know, wetlands and steep slopes.
Right,
and
for now.
Stuff like that.
Okay. Okay, that's helpful. And then the, so for under 10 units, there's no requirement.
Performance standards option subdivision.
So there's no requirement at all for open space of any form.
If it's a performance standards option
subdivision.
Yeah.
Correct. So you can avoid all of this if you build less than 10, you can do whatever you want.
Well, not in a multifamily zone, just in a single family zone, because when you get to the multifamily zones, you have to meet the residential design standards.
Which
and
are
the open space, the recreation area requirement.
Of at least 8%.
Yes.
Right.
That's
so
not tied to the number of units.
Yeah. So the non-PSO developments have to meet the open space, but the PSO developments that are under 10 units wouldn't have to comply with this, would they? I mean, the whole point of this is that you don't comply with the basic design standards.
No.
Depends on the zone.
If you're in a multifamily zone and you're doing a development in multifamily configuration, then you're subject to the residential design standards, which require 8%. So the way that's been applied in the past is that this is a more stringent standard, and therefore any multifamily development has to meet those requirements, the 8% of recreation area.
Okay, and so I just, and I'm not trying to argue with you, I'm just not sure where that is in the current code. I copied off the provisions of the current code without all the markups to try to understand that, and I'm not sure quite where that is.
So when you go to the site design review chapter, under applicability, it says it applies to any development of 2 units or greater, and then it says you have to meet the standards of residential design.
Okay, but we're not talking about 8.4.2
yes,
residential
yes.
standards. We are talking about that. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Billy?
Well, questions. I mean, I had some comments about what you've done. I'm a little, like, you gave a presentation, but are we going to dig into the specifics of your changes, or do you feel like you've already presented?
I think it depends on what you want to do. I would encourage us to talk a little more. I think this is really helpful to try to graph something. You don't know where the holes are until you try to start grafting. You don't know where the difficulties are with the grafting until you try to start grafting something. So I appreciate staff doing this. I have some some questions and comments about it as well, like yards are defined. The definition of yard doesn't work. And some of the other definitions don't work and seem to not further our goal of increasing clarity. But I encourage us to back off a little bit and talk about what we want to see in the three different areas where we run into this, which is the performance standards option, the multifamily design standards, and also, what is this, an 18.25, the density bonus for residential. I mean, what in broad brush do we want to accomplish with those?
But it also seems like that we have two levels that we need to accomplish. One is to fix the current code where the definitions are matching the intent of what we're trying to do, both the percentages and what is open space and recreational space and private space.
Yeah,
so that's where this started, to clarify that before we started trying to change the actual requirements themselves. Because that's what it seems to be a lot of comments we've gotten, at least those I've read, is more about changing what we're actually trying to accomplish as a code versus first. We can first get the definitions clarified of what we're trying to define as open space, recreational space, and private space. Mm-hmm. And then where can they apply in the different overlays and in what are their percentages. Once that's solidified, then we can go back and start taking a look at how we change specific requirements within it. Should it be 6 feet or 4 feet? Should it be there at all? Should it not be there at all?
Yeah.
Exactly. That's phase two.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking phase one is to get the part that was presented, which I thought, by and large, tried to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. To make the definitions go the way we thought they should go. What is open space? What is recreational space? And which ones apply to which overlay? Mm-hmm. So that's the one that I'm looking at, and that's what I was when I was reviewing. Wasn't worrying about some of the small stuff. I'm trying to get the definition that I can now sit down and say, we're talking recreational space or we're talking open space. Mm-hmm. And not the other things that are going to come up that we actually need to fix or change or leave alone.
Yeah.
Definition.
So what do people think about the 5% requirement for the PSO overlay? Are we satisfied that that should be in a common area that is a common area which is defined as, you know, commonly owned by a homeowner association and not in a privately owned?
For more than 10 units. Is that what you mean?
Where it applies.
Yeah,
for more than 10 units in a, you know, performance standards option development
context.
Or
so you're asking this question because this is something that has not been well defined in the past, whether it was or whether it was not. And we were recently interpreting it as required to be common, whereas in the past it may have been interpreted differently. Is that correct?
I think for the PSO stuff, it's always been interpreted to require it to be common area as defined in the code, which is commonly owned for the PSO overlay, more than 10 units. Now, for the site design standards, we have been, we need clarity there about whether it should be, not whether it should be commonly owned or not, but whether it should be accessible to all residents of the unit or only accessible to some residents of the unit. Is that residential space? Is it okay for it to be, private decks, for example? But first I'd like to ask you about the PSO overlay. You know, for the 5% requirement there, currently it requires it to be common area that's commonly owned by a homeowners association. Is that right, Maria?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's like the first example.
Yeah, and
are we okay
with that in a PSO overlay subdivision context?
And that's on page 3 under open space requirement.
Well,
I think
I have some
just that
questions. I have some questions about the drafting there, but I just want to get to the broad brush intent, and we can work on the drafting later.
I guess the way I would approach it, in my mind, is to ask whether or not you can develop that same development under different sections of the code and whether it makes sense to have different standards that apply. So in a multifamily zone, if you could develop 10 units or greater, you know, base density of 12 units or greater, and you need 8%, but it doesn't have to be common areas at all. It can be all backyards. And then if you do it under the performance standards overlay, you need 5% that must be common.
Right.
And I guess...
That's not necessarily inconsistent.
Well, it's a more specific requirement. You don't have to have any common space in one, and you do in the other, and then what additional private space do you need? That's sort of how my mind wants to look at it, is why would you be making, you know, rationally making a distinction one to the other? Is there some reason why your requirements would be different in one context versus another? And does that make sense? Because percentages, to me, it's very hard for me to say, oh, the number should be 5%, you know. The number should be 8%. I don't know, you know, sitting here, you know, what the implications of that are. So I'm looking for congruity, I guess, in what the standards are.
I think when we're talking about the numbers themselves, we need to go a little bit on trust that the original numbers laid out had some research and background to them, or some, you know, models, right? As we often work in planning with models that other people are using. And I'm not sure we want to go with, like, is that the right percentage right now? But for me, when we're talking about requiring common open space in the multifamily zoning, it makes more sense because those developments are more dense. They have, you know, they're packing in a lot more housing units into a smaller space, and they are groups. They're always, you know, that's why it's multifamily, right? They're groups of housing together. And it just makes sense to me that would be reasonable to have some common open space that people could share, which would increase everybody's access to a usable amount of space.
You're talking about the design, most family design standards. No?
Right.
And that's the same thing, which I agree with. Totally. Is that the numbers themselves came from how lots are, how big they are, and how many percentages allow you in open space. But when you put in multifamily places, they're not going to have much private space. And so to do that, you must have everybody agree, make basic planning. You need common areas. Single family residences have bigger lots, bigger areas for common. True, you don't necessarily get a common open space that's actually a recreational space, but you do have common open space. And that protects a lot of the land that's basically within the development around them. So I think the number specifically came from other methodologies.
Yeah.
Then they haven't tested.
Well, that brings me to my second question. What do we feel about who would think about the multifamily design standards, which have this 8% open space / recreation space? Open space is used in a lot of contexts and maybe it needs clarifying. But we have allowed, based on the language in the code, some of that space requirement to be satisfied by sort of semi-private areas, decks, backyards, things like that. And the way this is currently drafted, it allows a complete trade-off. You could come in with 100%. I mean, this is just an idea to sort of point out, you know, the questions for us, which I appreciate. But the way it's currently drafted in here, a developer could come in with satisfying that 8% requirement with nothing but private decks. And they could come in and satisfy that 8% requirement with nothing but area that all the residents can access. You know, more traditionally, what do you think of it is what I think of as a common open space. And are we okay with that? Or do we want it all common open space? Or do we want a certain percentage of it to be common, and a certain percentage is okay to be in these more private areas? And we have to have something that's relatively clear because of the needed housing ordinance.
And you're just talking about the design standards now, right? Just the design, the residential
design
standards.
This is just the multifamily residential design standards.
Well, that was the question I was asking. Do you want to require open space there if you require it in an R3, you know, where you've got enough units that it makes sense to...
Well, we do require it now, but we have...
It can be private.
Our interpretation has been that the code allows these private time spaces to satisfy that.
Right.
And Noli has argued, in my mind convincingly, that at least some of that really needs to be more common area that all the residents can access that area. And the question is, does it all need to be that? But we haven't interpreted it that way in the past.
I didn't read it that way. The way you defined it, I did not read it that you need to have one or the other. I thought it was combined.
I thought it was some of both. I did not think it was all of one or all of the other.
It's not all of one or all of the other, but you can do all of one or all of the other.
That's what I'm saying. I did not read it that way.
But we're just hearing what the language here says.
Then on the first page.
It's on page one.
Okay. It's 18.4.2H, right?
Yes.
And last
thing is this.
But just to be clear, that's the way it was applied in a very flexible way in the past. What I've written here, I think, is consistent with past applications.
We're not, in staff mind, suggesting
that this is a change from past practice. It's just
But if you could clarify for us how it's written, the way I read it is that you could come in with 100% decks, or you know, that are attached to private units, or you could come in with 100% common yard area.
Yes, and it's
the developer's choice, not ours.
Yeah, and that's the way it's been applied in the past, and that's the way it's written.
Now, well, in my view, I think at least half of it's got to be accessible to all of us, or otherwise, it's you know. I think that's just a better way to do multifamily.
Sort of anecdotally, as I just love to pick on Medford. But as I've noticed a lot of the new subdivisions that have happened, it shows exactly what we're talking about. I have a lady friend that lives in one of these that is, they're doing 10 units per acre. Everything is private. You know, there's absolutely, and you go on for square miles of subdivision with absolutely no common area. The kids are, you know, basically it's just playing the street.
Yep, no parks.
Yeah.
And then there's no park area.
It's ridiculous. And I've watched them, particularly some of the new development out towards Croker View, which is it kind of just shows exactly what you're saying in our code, because we have done these things where all of a sudden we're just writing off, you know, the private decks and everything to satisfy, you know, with absolutely nothing there that people kind of, gather around. I mean, even with the Hellman Bass property, you know, that was a big thing. We got into the other thing. Does it have to be usable or not? But this was a wetland, and they made it somewhat usable by having a path and a bench out to it. Mm-hmm. But it does, at least there's a recreational area there. And I think that the one other thing that kind of comes in, which you also pointed out, there are no parks. But in this area, there's all of the Hellman ball fields close by. So you get, you know, recreational, at least close by, which as I say in Medford, there's nothing close by. I mean, you're a mile and a half from, you know, the first place that you can actually play on. It doesn't add, you know, all the percentages and stuff kind of go from my head.
Yeah, but that does point to the fact that you would support at least requiring some of it to be accessible to all residents.
Yeah, I've kind of felt that all the time that we've been wrestling with this, that there should be...
Can you put a number on that? Or is it,
I can't, no.
Yeah, I mean, all of it, or half of it, three-quarters of it?
We can start with half. Work.
That goes, actually, half is basically on my mind.
Start with half and then work with it.
Yeah, I mean,
that's our comment.
Yeah, I mean, well, without, you know, the...
You're going for half of eight. Is that what you're talking about? Half of eight.
Right. Yeah.
Which is a little bit less than the idea that we had that if there was...
At least 4% of it.
5%.
At least 4% of it would have to be... At least half of that 8% requirement would have to be accessible to all of us.
But like we're saying, that is the starting point. Change that to a given percentage. Instead of beginning with the 8%,
yeah.
Including divide the 8% up, say 5% goes here, 3% goes there.
We could do design standards or things for it, but I'm leery of that because of our legislature and their wisdom has said that we can only apply clear and objective standards to housing, all housing. So it has to be something that's very clear.
Are we still talking 10 units or more?
No, we're talking 18 for 2. Everything.
Yeah, so that's even a single family home, that wouldn't make any sense, right? On
no,
R1.
Not a single family home in R1. I mean, this is only for the site, the multifamily site standards.
And the R2, R3, a multifamily development, regardless of the number of units, that 8% is required to be in recreation area, and the discussion is what,
yeah,
how much
well, that's
of that
a
is
useful discussion. Now, the other thing I yell at.
Can I just, but as we discuss this, it also occurs to me, and it's been where I've thought about, what does this do to our density type stuff? When we're requiring things like this, is it going to hinder increasing density?
That's why I said we started from the bottom half. Then as we take a look at it moving forward to the next draft, then one of the things that can be looked at is how it does affect density. Mm-hmm. If it adversely affects it, then one is kind of resist the number. And if it doesn't affect it, then you kind of leave it alone because we can't do all the numbers all the time.
Right.
Short meeting. Has that something to do.
And that's the reason I would like us to also pull into this discussion the multifamily density bonus, which is not included in this, which is in section 18.25F. We had a comment about one of those in the major recreation areas, and we have those density bonuses for multifamily. And what do we want that to look like? Because I think that plays into this, because in order to get density under our code, at least many developers will come in and ask for additional density under that provision. So I'd really like to. My question about this is it's not included in here and in this draft, and it's not included in our. So we have a hard time discussing it in the abstract, but I think we need to include that in with this discussion because that plays into the density issue. You know, what are we requiring there and what shouldn't we be requiring? Does that require. Okay, without looking it up on the code, I would hesitate.
Well, it's almost identical to the section B on page 3, the performance standards options, density bonuses, and the density bonus you're referring to are almost identical. So
they're almost identical, but I think that the differences in them are, as I recall, the differences in the different languages in them is critical. To their interpretation. So I really think we need to look at those very carefully. Any other questions or comments? Do people have any specific comments on the code language? I don't think we need to get too deep into the weeds on this sort of discussion draft.
So just to give you a sense when you're talking about percentages, this development, 30% of it was in the common area of the 8% that was required, and the 1068 East Main, it was split evenly, about 50% of the common area, 50% private. So just to give you a couple examples.
I had a few detailed comments that I shared with staff earlier, and I won't go into them. There are some things that, like in section on page 1, where it says that recreation area can be located in the common area or a private yard area. I don't think it makes any sense to use the yard in that context. It's a private recreation area. So it's not in a yard. Typically, it's not in a yard. Yards 20 feet from the street. And some of the definitions, I think, need work. You know, the definition of common open space, for example, defines itself by using the word common. And so it's sort of self-defining, and we need to work on that.
Are you talking about page five?
Huh. And all the definitions of yards also don't make any sense. You know,
the yard needs to somehow, especially in multi-family, needs to include balconies.
If
you use the word yard.
Yeah.
If you use private open space, and then
yeah.
It does, or private recreation space, which is what you want to define,
yeah.
Then that says, but the minute you say yard has to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, and this defines, I mean, it's just the definition of yard in here defines it as from the lot line back to the building, and that's not the proper definition. The proper definition is from the lot line back, however far the code says, you know, 20 feet. Because you can build your building back to it. Or if you don't have a building on there, you know, or the building, you can build a building. In some structures and buildings, you can put in a yard. Decks, you can put in a yard. Eaves, you can put in a yard. Under the current code.
Roger.
Did we confuse things enough for you?
I thought, you know, we can work on some of the drafting things. I just don't know whether, for example, I thought the incidental open space definition on page 2 probably could use a little work once we figure out what we want to say. Things about walkways that are limited to providing pedestrian access. I don't know what that means. I mean, walled off, you know.
No, we're trying to address that example. I don't remember several years ago we went to a developer mountain.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I just think that we don't want to talk in terms of things being limited to pedestrian access. It's just if they provide pedestrian access and they're not part of a recreation area, then they can't be counted, period. You know, I just, things like that,
yeah.
Just to not set up definitional questions about are they limited to that? You know, could somebody actually go there?
Yeah.
You know, that just that kind of thing. So
thank you, Counselor. It's not about the same thing.
Yeah.
It's a good thing we don't have Alan here. We
can exactly.
Our third warrior.
Maybe I'm just a little hazy tonight, but I'm finding this conversation incredibly confusing. The way that we're jumping around all over the thing and throwing out stuff, I barely know what we're talking about. And I'm actually fairly familiar with the code.
Yeah.
So I'm having a hard time with the conversation in general. I want to commend you for working on clarifying some of the basic vocabulary. The use of a recreation area, I think, mm-hmm. is really helpful. I think, you know, retiring the term open space is just anywhere is should be a goal because it's so many different definitions of it.
That's a good comment. Thank you.
I think it's still sneaking in here a few places that you might have missed.
Well,
I'm not going to try and identify them.
Staff used direction on that because what we thought we heard at the last meeting is keep the open space in subdivisions, keep calling it open space because it's more, again, geared around preserving natural features. But call everything in multifamily a recreation area because that's supposed to be usable. Like, people need to be able to go out and use it. So if that's not the direction you want to go, you need to know now because that was really what we were showing.
Well, it might be easier to call it common area. But we can just take a look at that in the drafting. Yeah, I agree with Melanie. This code, whenever we got in, it came baked into the code. There's 250 references to the words open space. And there are many, many, sometimes it means, we want general open space in the Cromley project. Sometimes it means a public park. Sometimes it means, you know, setbacks. Sometimes it means other things. And we need to, hopefully this exercise will get us a long way to clarify.
Let's stay with that one issue. I thought that we had ended up with, what Maria did, we ended up with three things. We ended up with common space, open space, and recreation space. And open space is still necessary, especially when you're doing things like single-family developments, which you're only talking about that area along creeks, riparian areas, other areas, wetlands. That's open space.
Commonly owned.
It can be commonly owned, but it's still considered open space.
Yeah.
Now, common may be the one that doesn't need a much more definitive area. A common open space could actually be a place that you can actually use for something, and recreational space should be able to play in.
Yeah.
Common spaces we've had running around, which are short a lot of times as just walkways, transportation areas, areas for which people define that they
streets.
Get from streets to point A to point B,
yeah,
and then there's recreational area. And sometimes we get those three hung up. And I think the very last one that we did, development, we had that problem, that which ones were actually access streets, which are common areas that you can walk on but you can't play on. Other areas were actually supposed to be open space because you can't play them because it's a wetland. And then you wanted recreation spaces, which we had argued about. What is recreation? Do we want to build tennis courts, or do we want to put it as an adult sit around the barbecue? So I thought that where this was going so far, I thought that you pretty well defined it almost. Didn't quite get there, but again, if we could get the second draft that got away from all the markouts and all the cutouts and all the changes, and then one more pass through by staff to take a look at it, because that's what I ended up looking for. The common, the open space, and the recreational space. And I thought the definition of some of the common spaces that you can't use for anything other than walking. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the other things we ran into, that if you put a lot of paths in, how much does that use up of the open space for the common space? We obviously know it doesn't use any of the recreation space.
Yeah.
But the common space and open space, how much is that used up? And are we happy with that?
Yeah.
And so I think that we don't want to throw out open spaces, in my opinion.
Okay.
We want to keep
it. Forget I said that.
I think it's useful. It's used correctly.
Okay, thank you.
I'm happy tonight because you often hear the coach tough to understand, ask them difficult to do this, developers, that they can't get a straight at it. But yet when we go through this, we never hear from anybody. Well, come tell us. And so we actually got a person who does significant development in the city of Ashland, listed 12 things. And a couple of these have got a policy twist in them, which that's not what we're here for, is to change the policy, like go from 10 units to 20 units. That's a whole different. But there's a number of questions where he says in here, I think it says that, and I'm not sure. But he's not necessarily disagreeing with it. He's just asking for the clarification. So he is the developer who deals with this on a much, much, much detail than I do. And he's asking some questions here. And what he's saying is, I think it says that, but I'm not sure. So on those that don't involve policy, I think this gets a real good test to take. Because I think basically he's very complimentary in here. He's just not sure.
Yeah.
And he's saying, maybe if you move this to there, he's not saying change it. He said, put this here or put that there. So I think we've got someone is not just sitting out there making general statements about staff, difficult to deal with that, code this, that. And we've got somebody that actually showed up and so. There may be some hope.
Out of the 12,
I just ran through them real quick. There's probably 7 or 8 in there which fall into that clarification. So maybe use this as a test. And
those are useful comments.
And the comments that were provided by the other people are valuable as well. It's hard to really read them and be in the meeting at the same time, so I think we're going to need to go back.
I thought Ms. Neri's comments and Mr. Zucker's comments were helpful. Anything else?
I had only just started. I had a lot of notes here, which, I think we're going to, but most of the things I have thought of are probably already addressed in the comments from the public, which you are going to look through and imagine and make sure that you've answered the questions. Second story decks, you didn't address specifically, and I think need to be addressed because it's come up. Being specific about how much area in front of our doors, is needed, is being excluded, which was also a comment from the public. I found I had a little bit of a question about whether or not slopes too steep for development were included in required, you know, it just came up as a question for me. I mean, we're protecting natural features, and they're not, but then there's other things about land that's not developable, and I'm talking about page 42A. I just had a little bit of a question. And I can't even exactly remember what I was thinking. I just knew that it left me with a question in my mind about it.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the first thing that you said.
Slopes too steep for development.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's how they're being categorized.
So, I mean, just so you know, the gray out language is all existing in the code.
Right.
So we didn't.
It's not something that you changed that I'm commenting
right,
on.
Right.
And yet. while we're defining everything.
While we're here.
I found that I had some questions about the
definition.
Oh, you're more
speaking to what qualifies as that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I found that I was a little bit curious about cottage housing and density bonus points for open space. We just excluded any possibility of that within our ordinance already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The cottage housing is sort of its own animal.
Right. I think that we can do better with our definition of major recreational facilities, since that continues to be a question. I mean, we've talked about including community gardens specifically, but maybe we want to try and find the type of major recreational facility that we just approved last month. I'm not quite sure how. Adult playground?
I was just hoping we could just call it a large play area. A large recreation area. And leave it alone, rather than try to define with all the things we could list.
Yeah.
All the public stuff and fireplaces and cookouts, and mm-hmm. rather than that, try to come up with something that is a major recreational area. Mm-hmm. We may have to go back and keep doing this and find major, but that gives us something to do if we don't define it. But, you know, trying to define that area, what to use it with, but the last one I thought was a very good solution, but it didn't quite fit the definition or voted against it because of that. And then once we do all the argument and the information, then we finally figure out, well, an adult recreational area. We don't want to define that either.
It's also under appeal right now. But
right.
So we shouldn't be discussing it too specifically.
No, we can discuss it. But, you know, it's just in terms of clarifying that piece of the code. And
it's just that word that's right there. How do we make that speak to what we want to say without having maybe to list them? Without having a list of activities.
Yeah, that's...
If there's a way that we can do it without listing activities would help a lot.
Yeah.
That might help a lot.
Maybe it was a square footage thing. Maybe it's a percentage of the overall space thing. And but a way to do it without having to say what the activity is would really get us off the hook.
Okay.
On your page 5, at the very bottom of the page, this recreation area being defined, it says, design intended for outdoor sports and leisure time activities or residents of the development, recreation areas are improved. And this just brought up something for me on this.
Suitable surfaces.
On this project right here, mm-hmm. we said that their area kind of in the back that was under the trees that you could walk around under didn't need to be improved, but we were considering it a usable area for mm-hmm. recreation. I mean, just in the sense of people being able to go out there. So I have a question there about improved.
I think improved is the wrong word.
Yeah.
The shall have a suitable surface for human use.
Right. And we know that, like, we say we've excluded bark, mulch, and shrubs and all that because we know that people are not supposed to walk around in there, right? But there's something about that. There are natural areas that are not improved that can be used, and I want to make sure we don't exclude them because they're wonderful. And I think that covers most of the things that I noticed there.
Well, on that same note, under private yards and recreation, mm-hmm. we do have the minimum, dimensions of private recreation shall be a minimum of 6 feet. And that could be in depth. Or
well, we did take that from the porch standard, but we thought we were trying to make it more engineer because if the commission were to retain that part about saying that decks and patios could count, we were thinking really, 6 feet each way.
Right.
So, I know some of the comments that you received were said, you should say this is just for porches. But we thought it seemed like in the past developments that there's always kind of this push and pull about how big of a space should count. So we're trying to make it more objective and using that porch standard, but I don't know if that's
really required. It does need to be objective.
Well, I was thinking that the 6 feet square wouldn't quite necessarily fit something which was outside of the patio door that was only 4 feet. So my thought was if it was always 6 feet in width and let the length go wherever it goes. So rather than a 6 foot square, you would have a 6 foot width.
But I think I thought that meant that every dimension has to be at least 6 feet.
So I was trying to have the secondary dimension, the length dimension, more flexible by having 6 feet depth minimum. And let the other one go where it may.
Could be
more if you want to be 6 feet by two.
2 inches.
Yeah, there's always somebody.
Yeah. You're really saying perpendicular to the door.
Right. Perpendicular. Okay. Now, again, I kind of like the 6x6, but again, it gets to be a little bit large. I think, especially if you're talking about decks, 6x6 gets a little large. You need to get it back down probably around 3 or 4 feet when you get a deck. Upper level deck, otherwise the cantilever is heavy. So a 3 to 4 foot minimum would work better on upper levels, and therefore they may need to be an upper level and a lower level rather than just one. But lower levels would be 6 minimum, upper levels would have to be something like 3 or 4. In other words, you don't want to add to the structural problems by making it.
And I would like to see us discuss that in a little more detail, or we think upper level decks are okay.
Right. For that one, I just got a clarification. You were thinking 6x6. I was actually thinking with them. So, you can leave them alone for now.
Yep. Okay.
Right.
Yep.
Anything else? Well, thank you, everyone. It was a useful discussion. Thank you, Maria, for all your work.
Oh.
And for the presentation. Thank you. We have one more thing, an update on the vertical housing development. And this is just an update on what was presented to the council by a
president.
So that it's while you get that teed up, let me update you on one other thing. Is last meeting we had someone that turned in a pink slip and wanted to speak, and I said, look, this is not even a study session, it's not nothing. And so, we don't take comments on that. We don't really have our own rules. The Planning Commission may have adopted rules back long ago, but they're not published. They're not anywhere I know of. So I think we should follow the rules set out in the code for commission meetings. And those rules in Chapter 2 of the Action Municipal Code says that if it's any agenda item, if someone turns in a pink slip, they get to comment. So I think that's what we should do going forward.
So you should.
And why did you not do that?
Because I screwed up.
Oh, sorry. I didn't have a differential
like
that.
They get to comment. Oh, we get to comment.
They get to comment. So someone who turns in a pink slip on any agenda item, they can get to comment. We might limit them to a minute. We can limit them to a reasonable amount of time, depending on how busy the agenda we have. But that's sort of how the...
I thought we always allowed them to comment on the pink slips.
We have.
There was a
comment.
I agree.
Do it again.
I agree, Roger, because I thought that he should have been able to speak.
Okay.
And
I just want to go by the state rules where it's not a hearing, it's not a hearing.
Yeah.
So this evening,
I was thinking this evening,
the two individuals that signed up at public forum could have signed up under the open space.
And they should have.
But
we didn't give them a hard time.
It's fine.
As far as I can tell from the city rules, they could have signed up under call to work and talked about that.
Yeah, but usually people start to talk about one of the agenda items, we ask them to come back later.
This one was a little bit different, though. Rarely do we ever get, this is an update where the council had already approved it. So, done, signed, sealed, for the person to comment on something that we could, but as I said, what good would it do for me to comment?
Yeah.
I mean, because it's already, but that's a very, very rare thing, and I think Roger I can understand how he made that interpretation. And
well, thanks for the support, but I think we should follow the rules.
Yeah, I agree. But also the chair, the rules will be allowed to catch
him. Well, we have an update on the vertical housing development zone, and you don't have to be all that vertical to be vertical in Oregon, is it true? Two stories will do.
So, this is like the Croman, that Commissioner Norton was just talking about, the Croman Memorandum of Understanding. This is an informational item. The council reviewed it last Tuesday, March 19th. It really came out of the Transit Triangle Project. One of the recommendations of Bernie and Associates was to look at the idea of doing a vertical housing development zone as an incentive to try to get people to build multi-story buildings out on the bus route, specifically Ashland Street. So that's where it came from. So the council at that meeting, it came up, oh, are you going to, update the planning commission? And we were like, afterwards, oh, we probably should keep you, updated on it. So that's why it's in front of you. So I have Fragan Estes & Associates is helping us with this because they, basically we ran several scenarios of buildings under the new Transit Triangle Ordinance Amendments using the same model that we did that led to the ordinance amendments, which is called Vision Tomorrow. And this is just to remind everybody the way it works is it really looks at the physical parameters of what's allowed on the site, and then it has a financial feasibility tool, market analysis connected to it that you can start to look at how, when you make changes to things, how that affects the financing. So they actually added a new layer to that, which is looking at vertical housing development zones and the tax credit and how that affects financial feasibility for this project. So just to remind everybody, I think you all know this, but what it's specifically designed for is when you do residential units above a commercial space, so multi-story buildings. And it's been in the state law since 2001. It allows cities and counties to establish these zones so that you can give prospective projects a partial tax credit. And the way it works is
property tax, yes.
It's a 10-year exemption, so they get the exemption for 10 years, but after 10 years it goes fully on the tax rolls. And it applies only to the building value, so it doesn't apply to the land. The only exception to that is if you provide low-income housing under the state law. And it does apply to all the taxing jurisdictions. So early in the process, you have to let them know and they can opt out of it. So that, the city can establish the zone, but since property taxes are collected for a lot of different taxing districts like Jackson County, Rogue Community College, you have to involve them and let them say no or yes, I want to do it. So really, basically, the way it works is on the ground floor, you have to have half of it in commercial uses and then you get a tax credit of, you get 20% off of your property taxes for the building value for every floor above that. So the second floor, you get 20% tax exemption. Third floor, you get 40. And if you have four floors, you get 60. And the max you can get is 80. But in the transit triangle, the highest we allow is 4. So it would be highest if we go would be a 60% tax exemption. And this basically just says what I just said. So the requirements under state law is that you have to establish one of these zones, and then they have to be located in the zone. And as I said, 50% of the ground floor has to be in commercial, and then you have to have the residential floors above that. So if this were to move forward, the way that we had talked about doing it is it would be completely optional. So it's really meant to be an incentive, financial incentive. It's not something that people or developers or property owners are required to do. And it, you know, again, it's intended, like, when you have an area like this that has not seen a lot of development, the idea is really to try to get a different kind of building type of development that you haven't seen. There's all kinds of benefits to mixed-use development in terms of locating more residents in the area where the commercial development is. It addresses some of the goals in our climate and energy action plan in terms of calling for more housing near transit to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And there's a lot of other benefits. So other cities in Oregon have it on the books, and a couple examples. In Tigard, there's two projects they adopted in 2014 that have used, they've used the partial property tax exemption under this program. One had 165 units. I think we haven't figured out quite how many units the other one had, but it's a pretty good building. And then in Milwaukee, they established it in 2017, and they have one project that's actually under construction now, and it has 110 residential units. So as I said, we looked at several building prototypes in the Transit Triangle to see how it would affect the property taxes collected. And the first example that we used as a baseline is a commercial, one-story commercial building. And we did this because most of the development over the past 30 years has been one-story commercial buildings. So we wanted to compare the property tax that you would collect from that kind of building to what you would collect from a multi-story building with a tax exemption. So I think it'll become clear as I get to the end here. But basically, in each scenario, we looked at a 150 by 150 foot lot. And what that resulted in the one-story scenario is about 8,600 square feet of retail or office. And the property taxes collected over that 10 years would be $382,000. So this just shows the taxes that are collected each year over a 10-year period. And I should qualify that when we talk about these amounts, this is all the property taxes, this isn't just city. So again, this is all the different taxing districts when we look at these numbers. So then we looked at a three-story example, which had 28 residential units and about 1,300 square foot of retail office on the ground floor. And over the total exemption would be $245,200. And this graph is showing you the light orange on the bottom is the amount in the 10-year exemption period that you're still collecting. So that's anywhere from year one, $44,000 to $57,000. And then the dark orange is the exemption. So that's the part that they get the exemption for a three-story building. So you're still collecting taxes during this time, you know, it's a partial tax exemption. And the four-story example, 34 residential units, 1,600 square foot of retail, the total tax exemption goes up because it's, you know, 60% versus 40%. And so it's $457,000. And this is that same graph. You know, basically the light orange, the taxes you're collecting is going down because you're giving a bigger 60% exemption in this case. This is where you really compare the three examples where it is telling in that in the one-story commercial, again, over that 10-year period, you collect $382,000 in taxes. With the tax exemption on a three-story building, you still collect more, $508,000. So that's in that first 10-year period with the exemption, the 40% exemption. And that's because mixed-use multi-story buildings have a higher building value. So you're just generating more taxes with or without an exemption. And then the four-story building, again, you, in that first 10 years, collects $446,000. So again, you're collecting more than a baseline one-story building of $382,000. So the conclusions really were there's you know, more incentive when the building is four stories than C1 and E1 because you're obviously getting more of an exemption. And I think Frey and Essay Associates thought we probably wouldn't see very many people use it for a two-story building. A 20% exemption wasn't something that would get pursued very much. And so we were recommending looking at establishing a vertical housing development zone. The city can establish additional standards beyond the state law. We could do local standards. So the council asked us to look at, I think it's Milwaukee that requires 20% of the units to be affordable if they're given a vertical housing development zone incentive. So we'll be looking at that. And I think that was it. And so at this point, we're working on kind of putting a draft program together in the zone for the council to look at a future date.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm thinking about the circumstances that we've had recently where mixed use with commercial on the ground floor has come to us and asked to be able to use it as a residential temporarily because they couldn't find any commercial tenants. And I'm wondering what would happen if someone had used this vertical housing ordinance and that happened, if that was the case.
Well, they're locked in to keeping that 50% non-residential commercial space at the bottom.
So the
city, we need to look into it a little more and talk to other jurisdictions. I don't know if anybody's experienced that scenario where somebody wanted to change it. I'm pretty sure if they did, they stopped getting their tax exemption. But it is up to the city to administer the program and monitor those kinds of things. So.
I just have one question. So I am not looking at the zoning map, but I think that there are some significant areas in the Transit Triangle that are zoned residential, right? R2, R3. So
on
Siskiyou, not on Ashland Street.
And most of the development potential is on Ashland Street. Most of that is commercial.
So I get the comparison to the commercial baseline when you're talking about areas that you would expect to be developed commercially, but I'm just wondering how the numbers really pencil when you compare it to the property taxes that would be collected if the development was residential. You know, does it, like and I'm wondering why that wasn't analyzed at all, because it seems to me that to get a full picture right here, it's like a no-brainer, you know, because you're going to collect more taxes regardless. But if you were to compare it to a residential baseline, do you think that you would still be coming out ahead?
Yeah, we could look at that. We looked at the buildable lands map, and mm-hmm. most of that land is on Ashland Street, like I said. There's some small pockets of R2 multifamily. So I'm not sure, given the resources that we have to dedicate to the project, if modeling that, makes...
It's just people own, it may not be vacant land, but you might have land with something on it that's zoned R2, R3 that somebody decides to redevelop if they have these incentives. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's necessary to spend time doing it. I just immediately was struck by saying we're only going to compare it to a baseline of commercial, because I drive down that border of the Transit Triangle along Siskiyou, along Tolman Creek, and there's a lot of residential frontage there that I assume is zoned residential.
Yeah, we didn't even know. The Transit Triangle isn't on Tolman Creek Road at all.
Doesn't it butt up against isn't
no,
that
we spread that out intentionally because it's all R1.
Okay, so I thought that was the border of the Transit Triangle.
Well, Tolman. It is. I mean, the bus route goes on Ashland Street, Tolman, and up Siskiyou.
Right.
There's a hole in our triangle.
But as far as the overlay,
triangle's intent.
Triangle is more of a V, okay. Actually.
Okay. I didn't realize that.
Could you use this in a multifamily zone without rezoning it? Because the ground floor's
got to be
50% of the ground floor has to be commercial, and you can't do that under R2, R3. You'd have to change
it.
Okay. Well, maybe that's the answer.
But it's not 50.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Right. We can't put affordable requirements on just projects, but when we annex, we can say, okay, if you want to come in, you have to do this amount of affordable. What I just heard, I think, was that if you want to use this zone, we could put a requirement, there could be a requirement in there that some percentage of it be affordable, just like you can do the same thing when you annex. And did I hear that right?
Well, yeah, under state law, the city, you know, there's some baseline requirements that we have to meet for the state, but the city can adopt local criteria on top of that. And so I think it was Milwaukee has a requirement that if you get you're in the vertical housing development zone and you use this tax exemption, you have to do 20% of the units in affordable, meet their affordability requirements.
That's a city where they're building fiber for two apartment buildings.
By the Oregon law, it doesn't necessarily have to be 20%.
No.
If you could say 5% or 10% or something.
So we're going to, actually, as the next step, we're looking at that in the Envision Tomorrow model to see how that affects the market feasibility.
Yeah. Kills it.
Because you need to, when you look at the model, it shows you the rents, you know, the rent you capture for a certain amount of return. And if those end up, we'll basically look at where those end up compared to what the affordable rents are under our program.
And I would probably think that, let's say Rogue says, well, Rogue might say, okay, we're not willing to give up our tax, so you still have to, they still get their But you could also, I think you could work out an agreement and say, no, we'll take 50% of our cut because we realize housing impacts us. So you could probably negotiate in there with those agencies if they were willing to negotiate. Is there anything in the law that would prohibit that? That's a hard question.
Yeah, I don't know that. I mean, it just says that you have to consult with them and give them a chance to opt out.
Yeah, they can opt out.
Yeah.
So
I don't know.
They can partially opt out. Okay. Michael?
Yeah, I forgot when our retreat is. I didn't write it down.
We'll look it up and send it out. I'll send it out.
We'll look it up.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll send it out.
I might be able to tell you.
Oh, well, I'll call you.
It's the weekend of Mother's Day. Is it May
11th?
Yeah. Oh, are we done?
We'll verify.
I hope that is.
Yes, because that was brought up at the time.
And if any of you want to go to this, we can pay for this.
Yeah, this time I'll go.
Yeah.